For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, I'm going to start with a prayer, and then we'll get rolling here. All right, Lord, thank you. We get to come together like this. We get to study your word. Every week I'm amazed at how you speak to us in such a personal way. We invite you here. Your word says when we're together that you're here with us. So, Lord, we want you to speak in a real personal way, in a way that challenges us, because we know just living the way we have, there's certain things that have been good, but there's certain things that need to change. So show us how, by your grace and power, our lives can be what you meant them to be, which is filled with joy and peace. And yet, in the midst of all of that, oftentimes we find ourselves in difficult situations, into a fiery furnace of sorts, like we're going to study today. So I pray that we'd be able to think and concentrate. Pray for what we're going to talk about here, too, about ways that we can help the homeless here in Central Ohio. So we put all this in your hands. Amen. All right. Well, this week we're going to keep studying in the book of Daniel. Open up to Daniel chapter 3. Fiery furnace. Could have used that this morning, couldn't you? Cold morning. But I don't think you'd want it this hot. The heat these guys had to face was tremendous. And I think the fiery furnace is a good it's not just a metaphor. This really happened, but in a way it's something for us to think about, because a lot of us are going to face heat. We're going to be on the hot seat, so to speak, in this culture. We may not in America face anything like imprisonment or death. I was just reading, there's a website called Voice of the Martyrs that talks about people that are persecuted throughout the world. And I read about two women that had spent almost a year in prison just because they had a chance to come before a judge, and all they had to do is say, "We don't believe in Jesus." And they said, "We cannot say that," to jail. 296 days in jail just because of that. They recount cases that happened in November of churches that were invaded, even in big cities like Shanghai in China, where the pastors were hauled off to jail, no trials and that sort of thing. So people around the world are persecuted for their faith today. In America, there is a kind of an undercurrent, and in the West in general, that's anti-Christian, that's anti-religion. In today's thinking, there's even a thread of thought, a very popular book, one called The God Delusion, another one that was a bestseller in 2007. It hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list in 3 weeks, called God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens, right? So in these books, not only do they deny the existence of God and of Jesus as the Savior, but the underlying theme is that a dogmatic belief that there is a God is dangerous. It's dangerous because it undermines a unity of thought, a pervasive way of thinking in the West, which is that everything is equally true. What's true for you is true for you. What's true for me is true for me. And so what we call for is not a personal belief, but tolerance as the main way of looking at things. And so what I want to talk about is what that means in today's thinking to be a tolerant person, what it means biblically to be tolerant, and how this all fits into the fiery furnace. So we got a few things to cover this morning. All right? And it's pertinent. Let's get right into the text. Daniel 3, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made a statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then he sent messengers to the high officers, officials, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the provincial officials to come to the dedication of the statue he'd set up. So all the officials came and stood before the statue King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald shouted out, "People of all races and nations and languages, listen to the king's command. When you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither," I don't know what a zither is, "a lyre, a harp, pipes, and other musical instruments, bow to the ground to worship King Nebuchadnezzar's gold statue. Anyone who refuses to obey will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. So at the sound of the musical instruments, all the people, whatever their race or nation or language, bowed to the ground and worshiped the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Wow. Now there's an oppressive regime. Okay? And so when we go through this, the first question, why gold? Why did he make, and you think, well, all these powerful guys, because that was the most valuable metal, make it of gold. But there's something else in this whole statue being made of gold. Remember when Jody taught last week the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had? He had a dream of a statue. It was made of gold, silver, bronze, iron, and iron and clay. Each one of them represented what? What did it represent? Different kingdoms that would rule the earth. And if we look back here at Daniel 2, verse 36, what's it say? It says, that was the dream. Now we will tell the king what it means. This is Daniel speaking to this king. Your Majesty, you are the greatest of kings. The God of heaven has given you sovereignty, power, strength, and honor. He has made you the ruler over all the inhabited world and has put even the wild animals and birds under your control. You are the head of gold. You're the head of gold. And what's going to come after you? Look at the next verse. But after your kingdom comes to an end, another kingdom inferior to yours will rise to take your place. That's the chest of silver. So you see what he's saying? Here's the gold. Next comes the silver. And the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, he says, let's make the whole thing gold. What's he saying? You see what he's saying? Each one of these represents a subsequent kingdom of different materials. He says, I'm going to make the whole thing gold. What's he saying? It's my kingdom's going to last forever. Yeah, what do you mean? That there's going to be one that comes after me. So he decides, all right, we'll make the whole thing gold. And now we need something to kind of glue this kingdom together, to hold us together. What we need is a common religion. So he says, that's what we're going to do. We're going to make this other religion. We're going to make this religion of Babylon now. And so as we go on then and think about this, think then the religion of the culture. He's trying to make a culture that will last. And here's what I want to think. I want you to think about, because here's what he's saying. You can worship your gods, but you must worship this one too. Because in that era, these people were almost all polytheistic. They had their own gods. It was the consummate cafeteria plan of spirituality. You know, you talk about having a cafeteria plan where you can choose this and choose that. You put it on your tray. Well, they had a cafeteria plan of spirituality. Because depending on who you were, because look what it said. He said that that no matter what people, look at verse 4, then the herald shouted out, people of all races and nations and languages. He had truly conquered this part of the world. And what they did is they brought these people back to live in Babylon, to assimilate them into the Babylonian culture. So he's looking at all of these races, all different languages. How will I meld them together? It's going to be through this. And he says, I want you to add this God to your personal pantheon. You've got gods, you know, to bring your fertility to your crops, to make your animals healthy and reproduce, to keep you healthy, to ward off evil spirits. It's fine to have all those, but here's another one you need to bow down and worship. Now, if you know anything about the God of the Bible and what he told his people, he said, first and foremost, the first commandment he gave them was this: you will have no other gods before me. So you see the tension this is going to create? All Nebuchadnezzar is saying, come on, let's just get along. This is going to make peace because I'll let everybody just have any God that they want to have. We just add this other one on, which is the God of Babylon, for them to worship. And if everyone agrees on this, no matter what their background or anything, we're going to have unity, we're going to have peace, we'll have prosperity. All these things will work for us here in Babylon. And besides that, he had an enforcement. And if you don't believe, I'll just toss you into the fiery furnace. So we have this totalitarian, authoritarian regime with power to carry this out. Well, what's he calling for? Well, he's calling for conformity. Why does he want conformity? He wants conformity because that will keep himself in power. If he gets all these people from these different backgrounds to come together to sort of be held together by this common religious experience and belief, then they will conform to his way and his kingdom will prevail and persist. Now, do you see any similarities between what he was saying back in that day and what is kind of the underlying thought today? He's calling for conformity. What's the one thing that he would not tolerate? Someone saying, okay, I have one God. That's the only one that I will worship. That's what he can't tolerate. And I think today, it's not called conformity. What we are called to conform to, though, is this notion of tolerance. And tolerance, as defined in our way of thinking, is this. It's that all views are equally true. Think about that. All views are equally true. So that's similar in a lot of ways to what he's saying back in that day. You can have your own gods. You can have your shrine with all the gods and goddesses that you worship. Just add this other one on. And what we're saying today, the prevalent Western worldview, is you can believe whatever you want, but what you need to put on top of that and worship as a uniform thought is that all of these are equally true. All of these are equally true. And you know what? That's the one thing that you will get censured for in today's culture is to in any way say, no, there is one way that is true. I mean, what do people say? That's not politically correct, is it? Because if I say one way is true, that means another way would be false. But think of the gymnastics that we're trying to do in our brain here. If let's just take this thought. All ways are equally true. All moralities are equally right. No matter what you believe, that's true. Can you see a little inconsistency in that? If we say that two belief systems are equally true and they contradict one another, how could that be? What kind of mental gymnastics must we do to make that all work out? If we have one belief system that says, okay, when you die, you are reincarnated because you will get in the next life what you earned in this life. Karmic law. What goes around comes around. And what's going around is you through this cycle of life and death. So you had a decent life here as a toad, you know, you were a good little toad, you know, and you've done, you know, took care of your little toad children and your toad spouse, and you did all the toad things. Okay, you're going to be reincarnated as, I don't know, maybe a lizard. You're going to work your way up the karmic scale until you arrive. And so it's all about working your way up. And most world religions say that the way to earn God's acceptance is being a better person. Okay? So we've got this one. We'll just stick to this one idea. Karmic law, reincarnation. And then you have another belief system. For example, the Bible that says for a person is appointed to die once, and then comes judgment. Now, okay, Can both of these be equally true? One says, no, you just die and you go in this cycle of life, you're reincarnated, everything happens again. Another says, no, you die once and then comes judgment. They can't both be true, can they? One is right and one is wrong. Or they're both wrong, but they can't both be right. And so I just appeal. We just drink this stuff in because that is the spirit of the age that says, well, then you're intolerant. But here's the way I think we need to view tolerance. Tolerance means that we respect, we will listen to other people's point of view, we'll engage with them, we won't be mean-spirited towards them, we are respectful, we're loving towards other people, but at the end of the day, we use our intellect, we look at the evidence, and we decide, this is right. And it's not just right for me. I want to find the evidence that shows me if there is a right way that I can discover, and it more than that, the Bible says God will reveal to you what's right, then you can follow that. And it makes a difference in your life, not just here, but for eternity. Wouldn't you want to know that? Wouldn't you want to discover it? Wouldn't you want to find if there's a way that's wrong and a way that's right? And so this notion then of tolerance, and really, let me just tell you something. One of the big things that this whole tolerance, multiculturalism movement is all about is don't you dare try to proselytize or convert someone to your perspective. You see what that's saying? Okay, if you believe in something so strongly that you're trying to push your views on someone else, no matter how you do that, like you would criticize me because I'm really trying to do that. Trying to help people see that there is a way to believe that's true, and if you believe that, it changes your life for the good. And if some of you are sitting here and you're kind of uncomfortable with that, why would you do that? In fact, in the multicultural world, it says that is one thing that's absolutely wrong. Don't try to convert somebody to your perspective. But do you see what's under that? Okay, let's have a conversation here. Okay. You come to me and you say, all right, here you are, you're standing up there, you got a couple hundred people, and you're just trying to push your view, you're trying to convert people to your perspective. That's wrong. You shouldn't do that. Have you heard that? What is this person trying to do to me? They're trying to convert me, right? They're trying to convert me to their perspective that says, naughty boy. What are you doing trying to convert people to your way of life? You need to just shut up and let people believe what they want to believe. What are they trying to do? They're trying to convert me to their multicultural view of tolerance, aren't they? You see, folks, people that have strong beliefs are always trying to convert people to their perspective. In Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, in the introduction of that book, he says, my goal is that every person that reads this book would finish the book a converted atheist. That's his goal. Okay? And so the hypocrisy is what... I got to watch my language. Is what agitates me more than anything. Okay, the hypocrisy of pointing and wagging the finger and bellowing, what are you doing trying to convert people or get people to believe what you believe when they're doing the same thing to me? That's sort of agitating. And so what I want you to think about is that is exactly what these guys faced. They faced this kind of a confrontation that you need to believe like everyone else. And just come on, relax, conform. It's better for the culture. It's better for everybody. We could have world peace if everyone would just get on board with this kind of thing and just not be too strong about their beliefs and just let everybody believe what they want to believe. Then we'll have peace in the world. Well, it's not working and it never will. But what happens in the rest of the story? All right. So remember, he builds the gold statue. He says, you got to worship it or I toss you into the furnace. Verse 8. But some of the astrologers went to the king and informed on the Jews. They said to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, long live the king. You issued a decree requiring all the people to bow down and worship the gold statue. When you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and pipes and other musical instruments. That decree also states that those who refuse to obey must be thrown into the blazing furnace. But there are some Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you have put in charge of the province of Babylon. They pay no attention to you, your majesty. They refuse to serve your gods and do not worship the gold statue you have set up. Oh, boy. What's going on here? So we've got these three. Remember, these are the ones that were with Daniel. And you wonder, what's the motive that these guys had? Well, if you go back to Daniel chapter 2, look at verse 48. This is after Daniel gave the king his interpretation. It says, then the king appointed Daniel to a high position and gave him many valuable gifts. He made Daniel ruler over the whole province of Babylon, as well as chief over all his wise men. At Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be in charge of all the affairs of the province of Babylon, while Daniel remained in the king's court. Don't you think these guys are just looking for an opportunity? You know, here are these Jews. They were exiled from this country that we conquered. They're brought in here. We were the one ruling the province of Babylon before. Now they're in charge and they're giving us orders. They're telling us what to do. Well, we don't like that. And now we got a chance to take them down. And there's no evidence that these guys were like walking around the perimeter with protest signs and saying, don't worship the gold statue or anything. They were probably just didn't show up. Or, you know, we don't know exactly. Maybe they were in there and everyone else bowed down and they're just like, you know, would the three Jews please stand up? Well, they didn't bow down or whatever. Here they are. Everyone realized, though, that these guys weren't on board with worshiping this statue. And so, what happened? Nebuchadnezzar, verse 13, flew into a rage and ordered that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. You know, this just so angry. Think, why does it make him so mad? He's like, man, I'm the king. Don't you know? You should be listening to me. I've got this plan. And he's probably nervous because he's thinking, you're the head of gold. There's going to be one. How am I going to hold this whole thing together? He flies into this rage. And it says, when they brought them in, Nebuchadnezzar said, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or to worship the gold statue I have set up? I will give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I've made when you hear the sound of the musical instruments. But if you refuse, you'll be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my power? You know, that phrase right there, when he gives him this ultimatum, tells us a lot about the heart of this guy. You know, and if you think about Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel had not only interpreted his dream, he told him the dream that he had, this miracle. And in chapter 2, where I'm going to get to it later, but he said, this is the God of all gods. That's the God of Daniel. And that's why he gave him the gifts, he promoted him and all these guys. And he comes now, it looks like he has a short memory. You know why? Look at this statement. What God will be able to rescue you from my power? Who has the real power here? Is it the God? No. It's Nebuchadnezzar. He's like, he's so full of himself here. He's like, I'm the king. I have the power. This is a taunt against God right here. It's a challenge. He throws the gauntlet down. What God is there that could rescue you from moi? You know, I'm the one with the power here. There's no God that could rescue you from a fiery furnace and the sentence of death that I decree. That's what he says. And then this is probably the most important section of this whole passage, It's the response of these three young men. This is where we can learn. How do you live in a hostile culture? How do you respond to these kind of hostilities? It says in verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up. Wow. Now there's some integrity in there. There's a demonstration of true belief and faith. That's what these guys, let's sort of pick this apart phrase by phrase. First of all, they say, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. Why don't they need to? Because their faith is secure that the person that defends them is their God. He's the one with the power to defend them. They're basically saying, our actions and our God will speak so loud, we don't have to say a word. And this is a principle we talk about a lot here, and that is that our actions speak louder than our words. Their actions had spoken in the past. I'm sure that they were faithful servants in the kingdom. The positions that they had been granted had been ones that they had filled and they had ministered with diligence and with love for the people. And now as they take this stand, they say, watch the way we live. Watch the stand we take, and that will speak loudly. A friend of mine says this, at all times speak the gospel, sometimes use words. You see what's in that? The gospel is the good news about who Jesus is. It's about belief. It's about faith. It's about the power of God personally involved in our lives. And he says, you can speak that in the way you live. And that's what they were determined to do. You know, they didn't lay out a 5-point argument for the existence of God. They didn't lay out anything else, but they said, you watch. You know the way we live. You watch the stand we take right now. And the way we live will speak louder than anything that we could say. And he says, he will rescue us from your power. So they've got the right perspective. What did Nebuchadnezzar said? What God can rescue you from my power? And they're saying, we'll tell you what God will. Our God. He will rescue us from your power. There's a confidence here. And yet, the thing that's remarkable, and there's a lesson here, and that is that they were courteous and they were respectful, it seems. You know, they weren't sarcastic, it doesn't seem. They didn't put Nebuchadnezzar down. They just quietly said, you know, God will rescue us from your power. He said, but even if he doesn't, we will never serve your gods. And so another aspect of this whole thing is that they're unapologetic about what they believe. They don't apologize for God. They don't apologize for his justice. They don't apologize for the way he's implemented his will in history. Nothing like that. They're saying, this is the God that we serve, and no matter what, we will never serve your gods. Never. And so how did he respond? Look at verse 19. Nebuchadnezzar was so furious. It looks like he had a little anger problem, didn't he? He flew into a rage. He's so furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that his face became distorted with rage. Ah! Probably growled too. He commanded that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual. These furnaces they had were kilns for firing bricks. There weren't that many stones for the construction projects they had in Babylon. They've excavated many of kilns around that area. So they would have been, it wasn't a warming sort of furnace. This is a brick kiln. Then he ordered some of the strongest men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So he wanted the strong guys to make sure they were bound tightly, I guess. And then throw them into the blazing furnace. Ouch. So they tied them up and threw them into the furnace, fully dressed in their pants, turbans, robes, and other garments. And because the king in his anger had demanded such a hot fire in the furnace, the flames killed the soldiers as they threw the three men in, proof that this thing was hot. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, securely tied, fell into the roaring flames. So as far as the king is concerned, it's over. I've made an example. No one else is going to disobey me. We've got conformity working here in Babylon now. We've made an example of these three stinking Jews. That's what he was saying. These people that are trying to stand in the way think they have the God to worship. No, the God to worship is King Nebuchadnezzar's God, the gold statue set up. We're done with these guys, but look. But suddenly, Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in amazement and exclaimed to his advisors, "Didn't we tie up three men and throw them into the furnace?" "Yes, your majesty, we certainly did," they replied. "Look," Nebuchadnezzar shouted, "I see four men unbound, walking around in the fire unharmed, and the fourth looks like a god." Then Nebuchadnezzar came as close as he could to the door of the flaming furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." Wow. So he saw four men walking around in the furnace. What's going on here? Well, it appears that there's been an intervention of sorts, right? That God himself intervened, the God that they had faith. You know, and the crazy thing about this, you know, I look at this and I think, does this bother any of you guys? It's like, think how scary that would have been for these guys. They're bound up. These guys take them down there and they see them just dying as they take them down to throw them in. Why didn't God just sort of head this thing off beforehand? Save them all the anxiety and fear and trouble and that kind of thing. Well, because God had his own way he was going to do it. He decided he was going to do it this way. Why? Because there was more than just these three guys at stake. It was a testimony not only to the king, but all of Babylon that he was the king of kings. God was. And he made it clear that he sent, it says that the fourth looks like a god. In some of the translations it says looks like a son of the gods. But who was this? I'm not exactly sure, but this is clearly an agent of God. Could have been God himself. God spoke to Moses in a burning bush. God can do whatever he wants. He appeared to Joshua. He was called the commander of the Lord's army. We don't know exactly who this was, but it's a messenger of God, or God himself comes into the furnace. Comes into the furnace. And I think that's something that we need to think about here. That in these guys, why were they cast into this fire? Why were they cast into the fire? That's a very important thing for you all to think about. They were cast into the fire because they took a stand for what they believe. They took a stand of faith in God. The faith part is that God will protect them, just like they said. Remember what they said to the king? Our God will intervene, you know, but even if he doesn't save us from the flames, we're going to be his anyway. That's the kind of faith they had. And when they took that stand of faith, God came into that furnace with them. You see, and that's the way the God of the Bible works. You see, I think a lot of us, the way we've grown up with a religious background and that sort of thing, is the thought that God is far off. You know, and something that can even reinforce this, and I think it might be in a lot of our mindset, is that we go to a special place on a special day, like Sunday. We go to a church that's a special building, and that's where we sort of meet God, and we experience God is in this one place at this one time, that God is kind of far off. He's not really engaged here in my life. But you see, God has made many efforts in the pages of the Bible as you read it to reveal to us that he's not far off. That these guys are cast into this fiery furnace, and who comes into it with them? God himself. You see, and the ultimate way that he revealed himself coming into the fiery furnace of our lives and of our culture is that he came and made himself one of us. Jesus, his only son, he sent. John 3:16 says, God so loved the world, that means all of his creation, that he sent his only son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have eternal life. In John 1:14, it says, and the Word. In the context here, the Word is talking about Jesus, God's Son. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Do you know how much there is wrapped up in that? Think about that, folks. And if you're a person that's kind of investigating Christianity, you need to understand this. You may not believe it, but you need to understand this is what the Bible's saying. That God, even though he is infinite, pre-existent, that Jesus in his spirit and his being was with God from the creation of everything we knew, and yet he voluntarily set aside his divinity, set aside the use of all of his divine attributes, is what Philippians 2 says, that he emptied himself and he took the form of a slave to become a human. Why? Why did God become man? Not simply to show us what God is like, although we see that. We see the love, we see the care, we see the justice, we see what makes God angry, what makes God sad in the life of Jesus. But beyond that is that Jesus' life, a perfect life, culminated with his death. And his death was at the hands of humanity. You know, they were given a chance. As Pilate brought him out on trial, he says, I'll give you Jesus, or I'll give you this criminal. I'll just let him go. And the people said to Jesus, crucify him. Give us Barabbas, the criminal. And so the consensus, the heart of humanity, was put this man to death. And as Jesus was nailed to the cross, he says, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You know, that's the view that God takes towards each of us. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. That each of us has this sense that something is wrong inside and something needs to change and that I need to be forgiven, that a price needs to be paid. You see, that's the sense that God gives us in our heart before him, that a price needs to be paid. And you know what? The price has been paid. The paid by Jesus on the cross. The debt that you owe him for your sin has been paid. But you see, the Christian message is one that's so different. It's not religion, folks. The message of the Bible is not religion. Religion would say, if I'm a better person, then I'll get to the point God will accept me. But you see, what we're saying here is that Jesus paid a debt you owe, and that you can never pay that yourself. No matter how many good things you do, no matter how many times you come to church or wake up and pray early in the morning or anything that you think might gain you favor with God, it's not enough. It's not. Because our sin has made a separation between us and God. It's made a chasm that we can't bridge by good works. There's only one thing that bridges that chasm, and that's his death. Because the payment, the blood that he shed, is like a payment that covers all of our debts, but you know what? It's applicable only to those who receive. So what he says here in John 2, he says, as many as received him, he gave the power, he granted the power to become children of God. So for people that are investigating, you know, this is the message that I hope you can see and begin to understand, is it's not about being a good person, being good enough, it's about being forgiven. About a debt being paid, a debt you can't pay, but is paid for you, but you got to accept it on your behalf. It's something that's between you and God. And that God has made his character clear to each of us by coming into history. Just like he went into that furnace. And he's accessible to us at all times. Well, as we go on here then, and look at 26, where he said that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are servants of the Most High God. What a shift! Who was the Most High God just a few minutes ago? Nebuchadnezzar was, wasn't he? He's saying, what God has the power to do this? And so, suddenly, you know, he sees this great miracle and he says, you guys are servants of the Most High God. And as we go on, look at how he extols God. Look at verse 27. It says, the high officials that crowded around and saw that the fire had not touched them, not a hair on their heads was singed, their clothing was not scorched, they didn't even smell of smoke. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel to rescue his servants who trusted in him. They defied the king's command and were willing to die rather than serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make this decree. If any people, whatever their race or nation or language, speak a word against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, where are we headed? Where's he headed? They'll be cast into a fiery furnace. No, he's got another one. They will be torn limb from limb, and their houses will be turned into heaps of rubble. There is no other God who can rescue like this, and I'm going to enforce it. What's this tell you about him? He really hasn't changed, I don't think. He says, praise to the God. If any people speak a word against... Look back at Daniel 2:47. This is after Daniel's miracle. The king said, truly, your God is the greatest of gods, the Lord over kings, a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this secret. What do we have going here? We've got a guy who's getting tremendous revelation from God. And he's having this superficial response. How do we know it's superficial? Because he says this, and then he comes back and he's tossing these guys into the furnace. You know, he sees this other thing, the guy's, you know, just strolling around in the furnace, chilling with this fourth dude, and he's like, wow, you know, but who's in control still? He is. And you're going to see, actually, Lee Campbell's here teaching next week. You're going to see it's not over yet for Nebuchadnezzar. He still has a hardened heart. I think the message is this. When you get revelation, it's time to change on the inside. You know? Because you can just see from this guy, powerful revelation was making no difference for him. Because even here, he's saying, you know, rip those people apart. I'm in control. I got to take this into my own hands. And I put these two words up here, act now. That is, you know what God is all about? He's about helping us understand who he is, understand how our lives can be different. Why? Because he's got more for us. You know, he wants our lives. Jesus says, I came that they might have life and have it to the full, or abundantly. That's what he has for each of you. And what he does is he reveals in a very personal way, he is touching your heart probably right now. I know some people, you're checked out, you're thinking about something else. That's okay. Maybe you'll come back to me for a second here. Thinking about your project. Now I've probably lost you thinking about your project. But here's the thing. This God is personal, and he's powerful, and he's real. And he's demonstrated that in the pages of history, things that are quite provable, I think, and there's a lot of evidence for it. And yet, a life of faith means that we take certain stands for him as he reveals them to them. You know, he revealed to these guys that he was the only true God and that they should take a stand on that. And so, there's just a few things that I want to think about. He really calls on us to be nonconformists. Nonconformists to the worldview that surrounds us. this, for example, this whole notion of tolerance, that just everything is good for everybody else. Everything is equally true. You know, we know that's not true. It's not, though, like we walk around. I don't think these guys walked around with protest signs and that, but they were respectful, and they held their ground as they spoke about what they believed. Yeah, and I think that's what we're called to do, is to be clear with people about what we believe and why we believe. What's wrong with that? And to help people understand that we should be unapologetic about the God we serve, and that He is good, that He has changed our lives, and that we are faithful, which means that we are going to come into situations that, here, this is scary. What happened to these guys when they were faithful? They ended up in a furnace, right? God rescued them, but they ended up in a furnace. And I think the God of the Bible, what He will do is He will lead us into situations that seem very hot, difficult, at odds with other people, and yet in that is where we see His power. You know, if they weren't tossed into the furnace, they wouldn't have got the experience of walking around in that fire with God. And there are things that each of us will face. Decisions that we have to make where they're decisions of faith. One area, I'll just take this one little area, and I think then a lot of you will be able to see how it might apply in it. But when it comes to the issue of like our career and our jobs, it's very difficult right now because of unemployment rates are high and everything. But there is a worldview, there's just a pervasive way of thinking that you just go as fast, you get as much as you can. And if there is an opportunity to be promoted, who would turn that down? Because it means more power, it means more security, it means more finances, okay? That's just the way everybody thinks, right? Why wouldn't you? Well, I know people that have said no to promotions. And why? Because they said, well, that promotion is going to take so much of my time that my kids won't know who I am when they grow up. And I won't have time to serve God in the way I do. Maybe somebody that has an idea like serving the homeless or the poor, or they want to teach people about God and this kind of thing. And you realize that certain careers just take your heart and soul, and that's what they demand. And I know people that have said no to like partner tracks in law firms or accounting firms or in big businesses, and people look down on them like, oh yeah, right. What an idiot that would do that. They went into the fiery furnace. And you know what I've seen, though? I've seen God work in those lives in ways that you wouldn't believe. Because I see people, and you know what? It's the testimony of a life well lived, too. You know, I can speak from my own experience, where a lot of my colleagues, for those of you that don't know, I'm a physician, but I've sort of done that part-time and this more full-time, especially for the last 12 years, people have thought, that is so crazy. Why would anyone do that? And yet the guys I graduated from med school, and it's been a while now, in the 80s, are like saying, man, I wish I would have done something like that. I can't tell you how many people have said that. Because they realize that all of the things that this kind of prestigious and high-income potential career brought really aren't the things that have made their life what they want. And sort of the whole irony about that is that the more you get, the more nervous you get about it, I think. That's what I see. Here's what I'm saying. Okay, say you get a certain level in your company, and you get a certain income level. And what do you realize at that level? You realize I have power, and I have influence. And if I have this amount of income, it gives me power over people. They think, they look at me in a real different way because I'm rich. And I begin to worry then. Because why? Because who I am is a rich, powerful guy. And that's who people are looking up to. So now I get more and more nervous, because what if I lose that? What if I lose that money? What if I lose this position in this company, and I get downsized, or I get fired, or the company reorganizes and I'm out of job? Who am I then? I'm nobody. And so the irony of it is, what you see on whales jumping out of the water and people surfing, you know, old guys surfing on surfboards, you know, you see those ads on TV. What are they telling you? If you get enough, you're going to be at peace and everything's going to be secure and you've got nothing to worry about. What I'm telling you is, and you know it's true, you get more nervous because there's more to worry about because I got to maintain this level. And what I think the scriptures call us to do is to say, to get your BS detector out and start using it, because it's a lie. It's not true. That will not provide what you need ultimately. It won't. And that'll be a fiery furnace, because there are going to be a lot of people that our society doesn't like nonconformists. So, some things to think about.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.